Siri's just gone off for some reason. Go away. No, stop. Siri, no.
How my Siri is responding to you.
How do I get rid of it? Oh, there we go. All right. Welcome to Thinking Deeply About Primary Education, the podcast that makes time and space to think about pedagogy, teaching and learning, professional development, anything of interest to time poor but enthusiasm-rich primary teachers. This week, I'm joined by Christopher Such.
Hello again.
And Neil Almond.
Hello.
And together, we're going to explore the paper from Sweller, Van Merienboer, and Pass called Cognitive Architecture and Instructional Design 20 Years Later. But first, Chris, what's you reading for?
Hey, what you reading for?
I've got a few choices this week, so it's hard to pin down, but I'm going to go with a paper called Concept Creep, Psychology's Expanding Concepts of Harm and Pathology, which is a paper that I was lucky enough to explore at work with people who understand this thing a lot more than me. The basic premise behind it is it looks at the last 30 or 40 years or so, at particular psychological constructs, particularly those relating to harm and pathology, and how the definitions of those have changed over time. So an example of that might be the way in which a word like trauma might have, if we go back to, you know, earlier editions of the DSM-1, earlier editions of that might have described that as something that had to involve some kind of physical trauma that led to some kind of psychological difference. Whereas now, you know, people might talk about being traumatized under much more or much less constrained conditions. And that's not just talking about it in terms of the way that it exists in like public discourse, but it specifically talks about the way that psychologists are using these terms in a looser fashion. And it looks at some of the potential causes of that, the effects of it, both positive and negative potentially. And it's a really interesting paper. It offers something definitely for those people who are instinctively skeptical about the way that some of this terminology is now used more broadly. But it also looks, it also offers something to those who recognize the positives of perhaps an increased sensitivity towards harm and distress in different groups in society. So yeah, really interesting paper, and really a quick, or at least it's not the shortest paper in the world, but you fly through it because it's really interestingly written. What about you, Neil? What are you reading for?
So not reading, but listening. This week, great podcast from the History Hit company called The Ancients, which is a podcast that Kieran, you put me onto, actually. They do jot about a fair little bit with their episodes, but kind of every kind of three or four episodes, there's one that kind of dedicates itself to like the history of human developments and, you know, various offshoots from our ancestors, etc. And this was a really interesting one on a subspecies of our Homo naledi, which were found about 10, 15 years ago in a little cave in South Africa near Joburg. And what was really kind of interesting about this episode is that this finding basically rewrites everything that they thought about human evolution and how we've developed the way that we are, in the sense that Homo naledi are, you know, very short, about 4 foot, 5 foot in height, really, really small brained, about the size brain of a chimpanzee, but carbon datings dated their bones to only about 300,000 years ago, and everything about what we currently know, or what we did know before this, was that these things should have existed 2 to 3 million years ago. There was evidence of fire, evidence of burial, evidence of art within this cave. So it's kind of something that's really kind of taken the archaeological human evolutionaries by storm. And it's a kind of what I, my immediate reaction to it was that if there was someone out there who doesn't understand like disciplinary knowledge and how discipline and how that can change, because new discoveries are always kind of making us rethink some things, listen to the Homo Naledi episode from the ancients, because yeah, it was one of those ones where I was driving and I wanted to just pull over and just listen to the whole thing. I didn't mind that I'd be late for my meetings because I felt like, no, this is worth it. There's also a Netflix documentary about it, which is also quite exciting. Haven't watched it yet, but Shannon's going to meet some friends for lunch tomorrow. And so I've dedicated that time to watch that Netflix documentary. I think it's called like The Man and the Cave or something like that. But it was a great episode. What about you, Kieran? What you been reading for?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds fascinating. It's right up my street. And I think the timeline still matches with what I've read about the cognitive architecture for storytelling and things. It's not quite as far back as 300,000 years ago. So my timeline is still intact, but I'm definitely going to see where this takes me. I've got a podcast as well. It's called This Week in Startup. And essentially, you've got two guys who, they might be chancers, but they sound like they've run successful tech businesses in California. And essentially what they do is they will sit and talk about the latest developments in their world, but also demo new products for each other and sort of say, this is what this is, you know, and it doesn't necessarily belong to them, but they're trying to share with their listeners, you know. And for me, it was really interesting because a lot of the information we have about artificial intelligence is coming secondhand through guys like this who work with all the time. And so I'm trying to go to the source and say, well, what's their interpretation? Because they're saying certain things are going to blow up in X number of months, and the exponential rate of development, you know, they think 18 months from now, there's going to be a massive watershed moment for the use of artificial intelligence. Because they were talking about how in November of last year, ChatGPT became a thing. And the things that it can do now are amazing us just as much as what its existence has amazed us. And then they're talking about this 18-month time. So essentially, yeah, I'm trying to find out direct from guys who work with this stuff all the time what the future actually might hold. So yeah, so if anyone's interested in some offshoot but still potentially valid podcast listening, then I'd recommend going to it. Cool. So this episode is the annual My Mum's Kitchen episode. And part of me hopes, you know, no one listens and then I get away with it. But last year's episode is probably like the fourth most popular episode that we've had so far. And so we were all sitting around talking about routines and there's quite a few of us on the call. And so, you know, I have to start by apologizing for the poor sound quality because I'm using headphones that I got with an iPhone 7 many, many years ago and they're frayed at the ends. But hopefully, you know, the fact that last year's went quite well sort of suggests that it's not too bad. And this was an idea you had, Chris, for podcast format, where we will take a paper and explore it in depth and then look at what the paper tells us and what it might mean for our practice. And as I said, we've gone for cognitive architecture and instructional design 20 years later, which obviously focuses on the journey of cognitive load theory over the period 1998 to 2018. And I think it makes sense to start with, what is this paper and why is it taken for granted?
As the title suggests, this is a paper that tries to explore the what research has suggested about cognitive load theory and aspects of cognitive load theory since 1998. Now, there are various papers that introduce the idea of cognitive load theory, but the original one kind of on cognitive architecture is one where the authors kind of pin down particular effects that they think are related to this and kind of explore it in more detail. And so it provided 20 years later a good point where they could look back and say, what's changed? What it takes for granted is Well, funnily enough, often when you read a paper, you think, well, what stuff is taken for granted in terms of the knowledge that's required to access this paper? I don't actually think it's that much. The introduction to it is so well written that if you'd never heard of cognitive load theory before, you would still be able to take something from it. You'd still find it accessible. But all that said, the kind of the background to this paper is, of course, cognitive load theory, which posits a few basic ideas that most educators are familiar with now, but I hope you'll forgive me for briefly running through. The key ones being that we can think of our cognitive architecture as being in part based around working memory, which is limited, and long-term memory that is in effect unlimited, and the interaction between those two. And it posits this key idea, this kind of idea of cognitive load, which suggests that it is possible to quite easily overwhelm working memory when learning new things. And so teachers need to take this into account and take into account what we know about long-term memory when they're thinking about instruction. So that's kind of the basis. That's where we begin. There are a number of effects that are described, as I say, in the original paper, and that are briefly and I think really nicely succinctly described at the start of this paper, the ones that people who are familiar with cognitive load theory will be familiar with, things like the goal-free effect, worked example effect, etc. But once it kind of sums up everything that they already kind of had described in 1998, it then gets into the other bits that we're going to be talking about today, which are the new findings, the way in which cognitive load theory has been buttressed by other aspects relating to evolutionary psychology, and also future directions for research.
Really echoing what Chris has said, it's something that I definitely read when it came out and definitely didn't revisit until Chris put this paper in as a subject of this podcast. And yeah, as soon as I started to read it, I was like, God, I wish I read this more often, you know, give it a good couple of reads and the reads that it does deserve, because as someone who is, I think, is pretty au fait with, you know, cognitive load theory, just, you know, reading it all again just, you know, gave me a new perspective for quite a few things, actually, and, you know, some things that naturally you would forget. And I say, I find the way that they've integrated Geary's ideas of biologically primary and secondary knowledge and kind of five principles that they talk about with regards to cognitive architecture. Do I think every teacher needs to know those five principles? Probably not, but are they interesting? They definitely are. And so I hope that we are able to not focus all of our efforts, but definitely sort of breeze over those throughout this conversation.
I think that's a really interesting point to start on, because I'm a big fan of Geary's work. I will often talk about how when I sequenced stage zero, I could see the journey from things that are typically biologically primary with regards to mathematics, you know, things that will have had an evolutionary advantage at some point in the past, but also things that we can put a number on when children develop a sense in the right conditions. Like, I think Cardinality is 3.5 years old. So obviously that's something we develop naturally, and we've developed the, you know, we can use our architecture to do that, but then eventually you get to a point where things need instruction, and so I'm on board with that. But there's quite a large part of this is dedicated to the incorporation of evolutionary biology into the theory of cognitive load. But Geary's work has its detractors. Does that cause an issue for this paper, in the fact that this is the foundation upon which it's setting itself up for the next 20 years?
I definitely think it could do more to point out some of the potential nuances around Geary's work. I'm not particularly familiar with Geary's work, but I don't think you necessarily need to be to recognize that the idea of dividing learning into biologically primary and biologically secondary, and using examples like reading as biologically secondary, isn't without issue, not least because if we understand reading in its fullest sense, then there are certain aspects of that that we obviously haven't had the evolutionary time to developed to become hardwired with, and yet there are aspects of reading that are absolutely leaning into and borrowing from, you know, to use the phrase, cognitive architecture that we have developed, that we have reached a point where we're likely to be hardwired. So yeah, I mean, particularly if they're going to use the example of reading, which is what they do in the paper, though admittedly they use word reading where it's a little bit more a little bit less ambiguous, I should say, they should probably discuss some of the criticisms of this idea a little bit more. That said, I don't think it's that problematic in terms of where they want this research to go, because all they're really saying, as far as I can tell, is that there are aspects of learning that we can think of as being more that we're more primed for in evolutionary terms, and then there are others that we're less primed for. Where they maybe stray a little bit beyond that is when they say, when they're talking about learning, they suggest this, and it's quite metaphorical, but they talk about the idea of saying that what we have evolved to learn is kind of almost like modular in our brain. In short, saying like we've got this is a very bad way of putting it, and they put it much more subtly than this, but there's like a thing in our brain that is designed or that has evolved and has this structure that's ready for these certain things we're going to learn, whereas everything else that's biologically secondary is like this one great big shared capability that shares a lot of commonality compared to these things that we've evolved to do. So at that point, they maybe are relying on quite this strict delineation between biologically primary and biologically secondary. But I think for most of the stuff they're talking about, I don't think it's that it will cause too many problems, as far as I can tell, at least.
Yeah, I think I know like some criticisms of this particular paper that I've kind of seen online very much Geary's ideas kind of act as a bit of a save all kind of criticism that like the original cognitive load paper sort of had, is that, well, you know, the fact that they can just bolt on cognitive load theory to Geary's idea and amalgamate the two kind of, you know, saves cognitive load theory a bit of face when it comes to some of the criticisms of it beforehand, and, you know, the extent to which that is true is far beyond my remit in terms of enjoying this kind of stuff. And it, for me, in real layman's terms, it makes sense what they are saying, that, you know, cognitive load and the impact that you have on load is going to be far more when we learn these things that you know, over time we haven't really you know, evolved to do, which are things like, you know, everything to do with our culture, mathematics, all of our sort of subject domains. Those things will be harder to learn, and they will impose a greater cognitive load because, as I say, we don't have that innate sort of ability to acquire these. They stay without instruction. I kind of think there's a lot of perhaps implicit instruction in some of these things and experience of some of these things. And to be fair, I think Geary makes that case as well. If you were to have a child and leave it in a darkened room, only feeding it, it is not going to acquire, you know, speech. Like, there still needs to be experiences with these things that we would deem as biologically primary. And so, again, I think there is a distinction, but I think the extent to which we kind of say that biologically primary knowledge appears or kind of is promoted kind of free of instruction is something that I think is worth challenging. And again, kind of what I kind of see really when you think about like what the role of our early years educators is to do is to provide those experiences to allow that kind of biologically primary stuff to really sort of begin to flourish, and obviously kind of support that transition to very kind of basic biologically secondary knowledge. The interesting part as well that I kind of thought in this was the bit where they talked about where, although these acquisitions of these biological skills tend to occur automatically and unconsciously, it doesn't follow that they use these skills unconsciously in every context. And so actually, you know, there are going to be times where we need to kind of prompt students to use these biologically primary skills. And then it's about how we can then use that within the subject's domains and within those, so those biologically secondary areas to kind of support them. And that was quite an interesting part of that paper that I hadn't quite appreciated that nuance on that first read, how like it's not like a okay, you've learned all your primary your biologically primary stuff, let's like now like park that, we're ready to move on to biologically secondary stuff. It's actually, well, how are we using that biologically primary stuff to support the learning of that biologically secondary stuff? And I think there's a few then questions with regards to things like, now that oracy is coming back on, well, you know, if talk is a biologically primary thing, then, you know, what do we really mean then? Like, what's that look like? You know, listening skills is something that I've seen again. Well, if listening is biologically, you know, primary, like, what does it mean to get better at listening? Is that something that actually can be taught? So I think there are a few questions there, but yeah, interesting nonetheless.
I think something you mentioned there is worth very briefly picking up on, the distinction between teaching and instruction, because I think they very much, when they're talking about, you know, this requires instruction, specifically, you know, biologically secondary is likely to require instruction. They are using instruction in the sense of, you know, explicit teaching, in effect. And so while we're talking about biologically primary, and obviously, you know, the development of spoken language is a great example of that, I don't think there is meant to be any suggestion that that doesn't require a wealth of experiences, and that the type and quality of those experiences can't be enhancing. It's more just saying that actually you can just be exposed to those experiences. You can be part of a community, in effect, and it will happen fairly naturally in the vast majority of cases, whereas you can be part of a wonderful, rich reading community and still have quite a large proportion of pupils who will struggle to learn to read without very much what you might describe as instruction, rather than just. So it gets into that kind of knotty difference between teaching and instruction, which is valuable in and of itself, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think Dan Willingham shared a paper recently along those lines where it was like, you can pick up word forms in another language just by passively listening to the language. I mean, that's a gross oversimplification of what this research paper was saying, but it feeds into that kind of thing where, you know, some things will happen with experience, and maybe it's one for another day. But yeah, I totally see where you guys are coming from. But I think it was important to consider this because I think we're going to spend quite a lot of time waxing lyrical about this paper, you know, because we were talking last week on the podcast about how we enjoy really well-written papers. And I think this is an example of, and I don't know if it's, you know, I don't know if it's because we've been reading about this stuff for a long time, but I find it really, really accessible. You know, I find it really clearly written. It followed what felt like a logical sequence, and there were reminders of that sequence and where we were in the sequence throughout the paper. You know, so even though it was 32 pages long, it didn't feel 32 pages long, which sometimes it can. So yeah, so I think it's really interesting. I think, you know, probably with things like evolutionary biology, we're never really going to get a conclusive answer. You know, Neil's talking about it is what you're reading for, about this new species or new ancestor of our species that was found, and it changed the canon, so to speak. So yeah, I think it's like you say, Neil, it's fitting with your experience, but also does it tally up with everything else you've read and stuff like that. I think it's really important. It's quite a long paper, 5 sections. We're not going to get to all of it. So I think if we look in 3 stages, what we knew in 1998, what we've learned since, and what the future might hold. And if we look at the bits that are interesting to us, and then maybe if anyone reads the paper, because I shared it in Discord a couple of days before the episode, we'll go live. Then, you know, we can maybe keep that conversation going. But what did we already know in 1988 that really stood out to you? I don't know if you want to take this one, Neil.
Well, being 6 in 1998, I didn't know that much at all, to be honest. But what do we know about in 1998? In real kind of basic terms, we understood that there were sort of these limits within working memory in terms of the amount of information that they can store, as well as the duration that we can kind of store these ideas in. We understood that there was this interaction also between the our long-term memories, which again, in 1998, we still appreciated that these things were definitely kind of was unlimited in terms of its ideas. We had this kind of this idea of in the three different types of cognitive load that they kind of described. So this idea of intrinsic load, which can only be changed by changing what needs to be learned or changing the kind of expertise of the learner. This kind of idea of the extraneous cognitive load, which is regarding the information, how that information is presented to the learner. So the instructional choices that we as teachers are making can either increase that load or kind of help manage that load. And this idea of germane load back in 1998, that's kind of changed ever so slightly now. I'm sure we'll get into that a bit later on, where and they define that as the load, the inherent load that it takes just to kind of learn something, which has quite interesting repercussions later on in the paper. Whereas, you know, how do we measure what that is? And I think, you know, if we trace sort of like the criticisms of cognitive load theory, I think this idea of germane load is kind of, is a thread that gets kind of weaved throughout a lot of these criticisms, which again, they try to address in fairness through this paper later on. But I say back in 1998, it's still there. They kind of help, I think, going back to our talk about biologically primary knowledge and secondary knowledge, I think they kind of use that to help kind of distract from germane load a little bit, or that might be what some people argue. And then in 1998, we had, which seems bizarre, given that, again, this was in 1998 and I went to university in 2010 and didn't hear any about this, quite a few of these kind of instructional effects as well. The one that really interested me that I know about but didn't appreciate its presence kind of in 1998 is this idea of the variability effect, because as soon as I read that, I was just like, real light bulb, oh, this is where variation theory fits into it all then. I can kind of like see now how I'm drawing this link between cognitive load theory and what Martin is saying within variation theory about how actually when we get to these kind of intrinsic level to such a point, when we increase that variance because we're reducing some of the cognitive load because they know what this problem is, so we have to kind of increase some load somewhat in another way, we're kind of by varying the way that they may be seeing these particular problems or situations, whatever it is, you know, for me that just kind of screamed variation theory, which I thought was just quite an interesting thing to pick up on. I may have totally overread into it and made a connection that doesn't necessarily need to be there, but be interested if any of you two saw that connection as well.
I did, and I think it's particularly interesting given some of the descriptions of cognitive load theory by so chap on Twitter, really interesting, Christian Moore Anderson, I believe he's got a book on secondary biology out, recently described cognitive load theory as not really like a theory of learning. It's a theory of the constraints that can be placed upon learning. And you can make an argument that the variability effect, if we're looking at variation theory, is something that goes a bit beyond that. I mean, and it's interesting, I think, that in that tweet or blog or whatever it was I'm trying to drag out of my memory from Christian Moore Anderson, he then mentions variation theory as, you know, a theory of learning. And he doesn't say that at all as, you know, as a way to deride cognitive load theory. I think he's just saying that, look, it has its purposes in terms of how we might describe instruction, but in terms of describing how learning happens, how humans kind of derive meaning, it doesn't tell us as much as, say, something like variation theory.
And obviously Neil and I are spending our time trawling through the variation theory research, because that's what we're going to do our joint talk at the Research Ed National Conference on is, you know, what was the last, 40 years of research told us?
I think it was a thread, Chris, and I had that exact same thread in my mind as I was reading this. I was wondering how this relates to, say, that distinction that you made between variation being like a theory of learning and cognitive load theory, not necessarily being a theory of learning, but, as I say, a theory of constraint as to how learning could happen, which I think when I read it, I was like, I'm quite sympathetic to that, view. But having read this now, yeah, might need to go and revisit that. Particularly, I think what is quite nice about this paper is that within the paragraphs for each of these effects are quite short, and there's a good kind of three or four references. So if you do really want to go and explore the history of these effects in a little bit more detail, just, you know, prior to 1998, or maybe just a little bit afterwards, you know, the references are there for you to follow up on. So I know, as Kieran mentioned, I'll definitely be following up a few of these to have a look if what's been described in those experiments resembles anything like variation theory.
I think, like you said, Neil, it was nearly 15 years later before this stuff was being discussed by teachers at the very earliest, you know, like maybe what, 2014, 13-ish. And that really stood out to me. It's like, okay, well, why did this take so long? Because it's changed a lot of people's practice, but it could have changed it quite a lot sooner. And that almost links into the other effect, which doesn't get spoken about that much. You know, variability doesn't get mentioned much. It's really interesting that element interactivity runs throughout this paper. It's quite a strong thread. And it feels like on an almost more molecular level, element interactivity is a core tenet of variation theory. But what doesn't get mentioned much is modality. Do you guys know why? Or maybe it's just mentioned, but not explicitly mentioned.
If you're talking about like why in the general discourse, you know, the modality effect hasn't been discussed quite so much. I don't know. I think there's part of me that feels at least fairly recently, the modality effect has had its day. Obviously it's been discussed in, you know, there's been lots of conversations about people disagreeing about what the phrase dual coding means. But when people are discussing dual coding, they are in effect talking about the modality effect. So I think it has had a bit of discussion. You can possibly argue from it that it's the one area of this kind of research that is most likely to lead to some slightly dodgy interpretations, because, you know, icons everywhere. But yeah, I know, in short, I think maybe it has been discussed, but that could just be my like my niche of Twitter or the internet that I've, you know, experienced.
Yeah, certainly Ollie Cav back in Research Ed Kent prior to the pandemic, so what we're talking about 2019, maybe 2018, definitely did a sort of a history of dual coding, and kind of he splits that into kind of like two stories. The first part being the modality effect, this idea of working memory having like, you know, subset channels of like a visuospatial sketchpad and some sort of like phonological loop that can kind of process two things slightly differently. And then you had the likes of Mayer, who then kind of took that idea a little bit further, and certainly that idea of kind of multimedia learning and kind of builds on effectively what I understand the modality effect to be. But perhaps getting Oliver on just to talk in detail about that would be quite an interesting episode for season 7, maybe.
I mean, that makes perfect sense then, because obviously David Daudet spent a lot of time talking about this at the very start of this sort of conversation between teachers. So if he and Ollie have sort of hashed that out between them and sort of covered all bases, probably makes sense that you don't need to go over old ground. So it might be that that's why we don't have chapters and books called the modality effect. So that's what I'm thinking. You know, most of these effects have got a chapter in a book, or maybe even a whole book dedicated to them at some point, but you don't see the variability effect. You know, maybe it, you know, these are the cousins that have been locked in the tower or whatever, you know. I don't know, was it the brothers? I don't know, English history struggling. Richard III, did he put some kids in the tower?
Yep, he's
wrong. Maybe modality and variability of those, but it sounds like, I see, no, they've been covered really well. Because one of the things that stands out from David's work was that representation of the phonological loop and its and long-term working memory, you know, basically the model. But it wasn't the simple model, it was a more expanded version of the simple model. So yeah, so I could see why that actually doesn't need to be discussed as much here, because it's, you know, taken for granted perhaps in many instances, although not as frequently in slides during CPD presentations as you might hope.
Yeah, and maybe that comes down to the inclinations of the writers in terms of what they think teachers most need to hear. And obviously, if we go back kind of 10, 15 years, where, you know, the original impetus for a lot of this, you know, these books probably came about, the big pushback is against teachers being told not to talk so much in the classroom, teachers being told to not be quite so involved, teachers being told to, in effect, being nudged away from explicit instruction. And I think a lot of the other effects, perhaps more directly, and the discussion of cognitive load more generally, lend themselves to that kind of rhetorical push in a way that the modality effect doesn't necessarily. So maybe it's, you know, it was just seen as not quite as useful or not quite as valuable for these in this push. And yeah, like you say, it has more recently had its day, but perhaps not in a lot of the kind of totemic texts that we think about where cog-sci was popularized kind of 10-ish years ago.
Have you got it up in front of you, Lynn? What page are the descriptions of the effects?
So the 1998 effects begin to be described on what is page 5 of the paper, but on page 6 and page 7, there's like a really handy table that they've conveniently added in, which kind of tells you what the effect, the first publication that names that effect, and a kind of brief kind of description of what that effect is. So a really kind of useful one to put up in anyone's classroom, I think, or, you know, have that up in your staff room for sure. On that positioning though, I love the fact that, and I'm sure, I don't, if it was done on purpose, it is quite possibly the biggest bit of academic trolling that I think I've ever come across. But it's wonderful because on page 5, they start a sentence. It's a multi-clause sentence, and the kind of the last kind of subordinate clause of that sentence is because they should not require the learner to mentally integrate different sources of. The next page is then that table that's been like rotated like 90 degrees, so you can't read it if you are there. So you have to then think about, oh, I need to do that. Two pages of that. And then by the time you get to the word information, that's the first word on page 8. You then have to scroll back up to think, well, what the bloody hell was that last bit of that subordinate clause? And then just the icing on the cake is that then there's a little parenthesis that says, see the split attention effect below. And I just think that is the possibly the biggest bit of academic trolling that I've come across. I think the editors must have had a real good bit of fun putting that together.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I really hope it was on purpose. I'm almost certain it was on purpose. I think, like you said, Neil, the descriptions are really, really clear, concise. If anyone's coming to this brand new and isn't sure, I recommend starting at that at page 5 and having a look at those two pages, and you won't be overwhelmed. Because I think if we go through all of them, we're probably going to be running a 3-hour episode, which, as much as I'd love to, probably not a summer jaunt through cognitive psychology. I think we're going to need to split it over a couple of weeks. So if we put a pin in it here, and we'll return to the rest of the paper next week, then I think we allow ourselves some breathing space to really explore what this might mean. So all I have to do is say thank you very much. Thank you very much, Neil.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Thanks again.
And to everyone at home, until next time, thanks for listening.